This is The Bottom Line. I'm Doug Wells, and today we're speaking with Gail Miller, owner of the Larry H. Miller Group of Companies and leader of the Larry and Gail Miller Family Foundation. The Larry H. Miller Group of Companies includes more than 80 businesses. In total, these companies employ more than 10,000 people and operate in 46 states. Gail's late husband, Larry H. Miller, remains one of the most well-known and beloved entrepreneurs in Utah history. Larry was also largely responsible for building Utah's collection of professional sports teams. Gail, welcome to The Bottom Line. It's an honor to have you as a guest.
Thank you, Doug. It's nice to be here.
The most important partner for any entrepreneur is their spouse. There's lots of stressful nights, lots of difficult decisions that need to be made, lots of uncertainty. First, do you agree that the most important partner for an entrepreneur is their spouse?
I absolutely do agree with that. And Larry and I were not only marriage partners, but we were partners in business.
And what were some of the things that you guys did to build that, both as spouses as well as business partners? Well, build that foundation.
One thing, I think we understood each other, and we knew that we each had a role to play, and we didn't try to overstep bounds, but we worked as a team. So I knew if he went out to slay the dragons out in the big bad world, I could stay at home and make a safe haven for him when he came home. And what that required was not having a lot of ego, just knowing that I was there for him, that I could provide him the comfort he needed to be able to put himself back together and go out and do it some more, because he was doing that for me. So knowing that we were a team working together was really important.
Yeah, and you know, we here in Utah, most of us know Larry as an entrepreneur.
Right.
But when you first married Larry, he wasn't an entrepreneur. And for the first several years of your marriage, you guys were not running your own businesses yet. What was he doing when you guys first met and were dating, and what were the first couple years career-wise like for Larry?
Well, when we first got married, he was working at a place called American Auto Parts, making minimum wage. The reason he went there was I had bought a 63 Falcon convertible with a 260 engine, which he immediately replaced with a 289 and drag raced. And every time he'd drag race it, he'd break something. So he had to go to the parts store and get parts. And he got tired of waiting at the counter, so he'd go around the back and look the part up himself. And finally he said, "Why don't you just give me a job here?" And they did. So that's where he began that career. And that really was the beginning of his automobile career. And then he moved into a jobber store, and then he moved up to a place. It was called Peck and Shaw GMC Buick, who then bought a Toyota store, and he had the opportunity to run either the Toyota parts department or the GMC parts department. There was another man there who was also a parts man, and they were going to give each one of them their choice. Since the other guy had more seniority, Larry said, "You go ahead and pick first," and he took the GMC. The General Motors side. Larry said, "Great, because I love numbers. Toyota is much more sensible in their numbering system. I'm happy to have Toyota." That's where he began his Toyota career. And I was working at the telephone company, actually making more money than he was when we first got married. But after about 5 years of trying to find just what it was that would light him up and be a career move, and not being able to find anything, he was offered the opportunity to go play ball for a team in Colorado. And that was his love. He loved softball. He had spent so much time practicing pitching, and he was a good hitter. So we talked it over and decided that we would take that opportunity, move to Colorado. We had two children. We'd been married about 5 years. And it was a little bit of a scary move for us, because they didn't offer a job. They only offered the opportunity to play ball, and they said, "We can set up some job interviews, but you have to get the job." So as we moved to Colorado, he did land a job with a company called Burt Chevrolet, who was also just going to go into the Toyota business and build a new building and get that franchise. And he was actually hired as the Toyota parts manager. Problem was, they didn't have a Toyota store yet. So when he got his first paycheck, he was paid as a counterman in the Chevrolet store, which was about half of what they had promised him. And I had quit my job to move and be a stay-at-home mom, and we knew that that was not going to support us.
That's scary. And I know there was a period of time early in Larry's career where he went through 6 or 7 jobs fairly rapidly.
He did.
Was that before the move to Colorado?
Yes.
or after?
That was before Colorado. He worked at American Auto Parts, Paint and Piston, Gresh and Jerry's, Main Motors, Peck and Shaw Toyota.
You know, I think that's an important story to share because it's tough being a young person and trying to figure out where your place is in the world. I was just going to say, and I think having the freedom to meander in your career and doing like Larry did, move 6 or 7 times until you find your passion, I think people feel less of a sense of freedom to do that today than maybe they did 40 or 50 years ago. Do you agree? And do you think it was a good thing for Larry to be able to meander fairly quickly early in his career like that?
I think you're right in that it doesn't happen as often here. I think today young people are ready to get the job of their dreams and stay with it and work hard and become something. But in those days, I'm not sure it was so much that he couldn't find exactly what he wanted. It was that there was something about each job that didn't fit well, and he was smart enough to know that.
And that's been 5-6 years there before moving on.
Right.
Once you know it's not a fit when you're young, you're probably, even though it's scary, even though it's putting you into uncertainty, and there's a smart way to move on and a not smart way, you want to move on in a smart way. But I just wanted to share that because clearly Larry had a passion early in his life, right? You knew it was baseball. I mean, moving to Colorado to play baseball, softball, without a job, that's a big, big passion. And the challenge, how do you find that passion in your career? How do you think Larry was able to find that passion in his career? Obviously, it started in the auto industry. How do you think Larry came to realize, this is where my passion is, this is where I'm going to build my career?
Well, that's a very interesting story because I think what allowed him to be able to do the job hopping was that I had a steady job and I was making good money. And so we were not really dependent on his paycheck except as a supplemental paycheck. And that allowed him the freedom of saying, I've got to find something better than this, something I like better, something I want to do every day. But the passion came in Colorado when he realized that we had 2 kids and another one on the way, and he had no college education. He had no particular skills, and he knew that he had to be the very best at something, that they couldn't deny him the opportunity to make a good living. And that's when he moved from that first job to when he realized they were not paying him what they promised him, he went and looked for another job. And he became the parts manager of Stevenson Toyota in Colorado, which was really a good break for him. Because they just said, here's the parts department, make it work. You do the best you can do, and you've got a job.
If you're just joining us this morning, our guest is Gail Miller, owner of the Larry H. Miller Group of Companies. So the Stevenson Corporation was a big break. In the auto industry, it sounds like Chuck Stevenson believed in Larry and let him really reach his potential. That's the good news. The Chuck Stevenson organization was a family organization.
That's right.
And how did that impact Larry's ability to move up within the company?
Well, for 8 years, Larry ran that parts department. Well, he started in the parts department, and he became Toyota's first million-dollar parts man. That means he sold $1 million worth of car parts in 1 year. And then he sold $2 million before anybody else reached that goal of $1 million, and that set him apart. And what that did was allowed him to get promotions. He became the parts manager, the general manager, the operations manager over 5 stores as Chuck grew his business. Now, when you mentioned it was a family business, when Larry started, the family boys were young. But as the company matured, the boys matured. And at that point, one day Chuck came to Larry and said, Larry, you know, I have 8 sons, 5 stores. I have boys that are old enough now to come into the business. They'd like to learn it, and you're great at teaching it. Will you go back to the Toyota store You don't need to take a cut and pay. Just go back and be the mentor for my boys, teach them the business. And of course, he knew you can't tell your boss, no, I'm not going to advance your children.
But that's what they call a career-limiting move.
That's right. And he realized that right away. The nice thing was that as we had advanced, as he had advanced in his career, we did not increase our lifestyle. We didn't, every time he had a pay raise, instead of buying more toys, we put it in the bank and saved it and then invested it. So that by the time this happened with Chuck and Larry saw that he was not going to have the career he thought he would have, we were prepared to go out and do something else.
And you know, saving is so important, particularly early in your career. And it's important because, A, it means you're not going into debt, probably. You're
right.
Living within your means. And, B, it opens up a lot of doors for you. There's avenues that are open that if you don't save, aren't open. Tell us how that savings account that you guys had built enabled you and Larry to get into the automotive industry.
Well, one thing it did was, one of the ways we were able to do that is that neither Larry nor I had an appetite for increasing our toy base. So we didn't want a lot of things, which was nice because we both felt the same way. And I think today, young people are so eager to have status. And having status means you have the second, you know, the boat, the trailer, the ATVs, whatever their fun limit is. But we didn't do that. We did very simple things as a family. And so we did not, like you say, go in debt. We concentrated on getting out of debt. And that's a fun story, too, I have to tell you about. But because we were able to save that extra pay, we invested it in land. And when it came evident that when it became evident that we were going to be moving on, we had about $88,000 that we reaped from that investment that allowed us to go into business for
ourselves. Land in Colorado?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And you were still living in Colorado
we
at
were.
This point? Okay.
But we came to Utah for a vacation, and Larry went to lunch with a friend of his who owned a Toyota store. And he took Greg, our oldest son, with him, and they were at the restaurant talking, and they talked about this store a lot of times before. But that day, Larry said, when are you going to sell me your store? And he said, how about today? Which just fell into place with what was happening in our lives. So they sat back down and wrote out the deal points on a napkin, went over to the store, wrote up a contract, and within 3 weeks, Larry was over here running that store. That was the beginning of our career.
I shared with you, I heard you talk at the Grand America, and as, if I recall correctly, Larry came home that day and said, what would you say if I told you I spent $1 million today?
That's exactly what he said.
What did you think?
I said, I didn't know we had $1 million. And I thought, wow.
You didn't.
We didn't have $1 million.
So how were you able to put that together?
Well, Larry had an uncle who had been in construction business here, who he was very close to. And he went to him and asked if he would like to go into business with him. So Larry's uncle was our first partner. But it only took a couple of years before we bought him out. And that was we were off and running then. And
so you shared that you have a fun story about getting out of debt. And I suspect Larry coming home and saying, I spent $1 million, ended a period of being out of debt for a very long period of time
for
your family.
It did end personal debt. Let me tell you this story. When we were first married, we had, our first son was 5 months old, and he had an injury, and he had to have brain surgery. And the bills from that surgery followed us to Colorado. But we knew that we didn't want to we didn't want to be in debt the rest of our lives. So we set up a system whereby we took our paycheck, listed our debts, leased to the greatest, and started paying them off, did our monthly payments. But every time one got paid off, we'd take that payment and apply it to the next line so that it accelerated that payment, and then did that all the way down the line. We got to about $2,000 in debt, and this was when Larry was working at Stevenson Toyota in Colorado. Someone brought in an old beat-up Land Cruiser, and Larry bought it for about $800. refurbished it, brought it back to pristine condition, and sold it. And we used that money to get totally out of debt, with the promise to each other that we would never go into personal debt again. So even when we went into business, we never encumbered our personal lives, and we never have. We've always stayed.
That's hard to do.
It is.
Good for you guys. That's an important lesson, that if you can do that growing a business, it's important, because it's stressful enough running a business. There's definitely times, no matter how successful your business is, there's periods of time where it's not entirely clear the business is going to survive.
That's true, and we went through that.
Let's take a quick break, and then we'll talk some more with Gail Miller, owner of the Larry H. Miller Group of Companies. Welcome back to The Bottom Line on KCPW. I'm Doug Wells. Today we're speaking with Gail Miller, owner of the Larry H. Miller Group of Companies. So you bought your first dealership in Murray, and over the next 6 years, things really started to take off. If I have my facts right, you guys bought four new auto-related dealerships. You built a brand new store, and you bought out your partner, who I'm assuming was Larry's uncle.
Right.
That's a whole lot to have happen in 6 years.
It is a lot, but Larry, you know, his book called Driven was very aptly named. He was driven. If he had a goal, he was going to get there.
Running an auto dealership for most families, that's a life's work right there, and it's clearly a handful, as you say. Larry was a driven man. Where do you think the ambition came from to expand that group of businesses beyond the auto dealership? Why was that important to Larry?
Well, it wasn't in the beginning. It was never a plan. When we bought that first dealership, we figured that was going to be our livelihood, and that would be enough. But as things happened and people saw how he did business, and that he was a person of integrity, and that the business was run well, other opportunities came to us. We didn't go out looking for them. In fact, on the second dealership, someone called him and said, there's a dealership available in Spokane. Was it Spokane or Seattle? I think, I can't remember. But anyway, would you be interested in it? And we looked at it and bought that one. And then, you know, from there, one after another kind of fell in our laps. We didn't really go out looking for them.
And one of those opportunities was the Utah Jazz. And I know it was important to Larry to keep the Utah Jazz here in Utah. Do you think he liked the idea of being in the basketball business, being in the professional sports business? Do you think if the Utah Jazz is staying in Salt Lake City, staying in Utah, was secure, do you think he still would have been motivated to be involved in that?
No, he wouldn't have. We had never even been to a basketball game before that opportunity came. Sam Battistone had invited us to one right about that time, but until then, we were not basketball fans. And the Jazz came to Utah the same year we moved back, in 1979. So from 79 to 80, we knew they were here, we knew they were in trouble, but we had not been basketball fans.
You know, it takes a really special person that's not a basketball fan that says, it's good for the community to keep professional sports here. If this team leaves, they're probably never coming back because we're a small market. It takes a really special person to take that leap to the next step and say, I'm going to do something about that. Why do you think he took that next step?
Well, I think that's exactly the reason he took that step, was because he knew how important it was to the community. He knew how scarce they were and how hard it would be to get one back, just exactly because of the small market. It was a real risk to even bring it here in the first place. And they struggled from the very beginning to make ends meet and sold players to make payroll. And it was always, will the Jazz stay or will they go? How are they going to make this happen? How are they going to keep them here? And finally, Dave Checkets decided that maybe he could get people to invest. So one day he called Larry and said, I think I figured out a way I can keep the Jazz here. Dave was the president. And I think if I can sell $100,000 memberships or partnerships, that we'll have enough money to make this work.
That probably would have been a disaster.
That's what Larry,
don't you think?
That's what Larry thought.
I didn't know that story, but hearing that story, I'm like, it's your your solution of last resort.
I think that's where they were. So Larry did say that. He said, well, I'm interested in keeping the jazz here, but I don't think that's the way to do it. So Dave went down and met with him in his office, and they talked about it, and he came home and talked to me about it. It was way beyond our net worth at the time. But knowing how important it was to the community and how hard it would be to get it back, he just felt like he had to do something. And Larry was always the doer.
You know, that's a huge gift to the community. And I want to talk about another business that you guys were in. You recently, you're no longer in the racetrack business, but that's another one that I view as a gift, and I want to bring that up later. But before we leave the Utah Jazz, initially Larry had a few partners in the ownership of the Utah Jazz. Why did he decide that, for somebody that kind of reluctantly did this in order to help the community, why did he ultimately decide, you know what, I think it makes more sense for me to own the whole thing?
Well, he didn't have several partners. He had Sam Battistone. Sam owned half, Larry owned half. And they had a Texas option when they did the first half, so that if Sam ever wanted to sell the other half, he would have to come to Larry first, so that Larry could say, well, no, I don't want you to let it go. I will step in and buy the second half. Trouble is, that happened the next year. And when we bought the first half for $8 million, the second year it was worth $14 million for half. And to escalate like that in 1 year put us under a real stressful situation, because we were still trying to figure out how to pay the first half. Then the second half comes along, and Larry's creative mind just figured out a way to do it. With the first half, we had to go beg and borrow from the banks, and he had to put together a consortium of bank loans and promise his life to pay him back, which, you know, we did. Then the second year, he was very distraught about Sam selling the other half, and because I believe it was Minnesota was ready to pay the whole thing and move him out of state. And again, Larry said, they can't leave Utah. So somehow he figured out a way to make that work, and we ended up owning it all.
So, you know, we opened the interview talking about the importance of being a partner with your spouse. This is a huge decision. You guys are putting a lot on the line to do something that's really a gift to the community, doing something that, hey, it was never in your game plan. It came up, and you, if you were in a position to help, you wanted to help. How did you and Larry decide about the trade-offs and the potential consequences to the other business of doing what you had to do creatively to finance this purchase?
Well, the automobile business really is our bread and butter. And Larry always said, I will keep the Jazz here as long as they don't jeopardize my other businesses. He was dedicated to keeping them here, but he knew that he couldn't lose everything just to keep the Jazz here. But fortunately, it was a good marriage, and the Jazz enhanced the auto business just because of the visibility of a major league sport, and the auto business was able to give the financial support that the Jazz needed. So they worked well together, and once they were both stabilized, then it became a no-brainer. There was no way the Jazz were going to leave, because they became a very good partner to the rest of our businesses.
Yeah, I can see that. The phrase, Larry H. Miller, you know this guy, I could see where that would build. And I think people appreciate the fact that your family was willing to do this. And when you're looking for a car, it's like, hey, I want to support the guy, the family that cared enough to keep. There's a lot of really diehard basketball fans in this city, in this state, as you know. So I could see where it would build. You know, it builds there, and it also speaks about integrity and values. I think it's a very public expression of your values and what your family stands for, which I would think is a really key piece of a component of succeeding in the auto business. Talk to us about how you do that, both sharing that message with the community, as well as, and perhaps probably more importantly, with your team, with your employees, so that the person going to buy a car gets that experience you want them to have.
Well, I think the very most important thing you do is stay true to your values. You have to know what you stand for, what you'll put up with, what you won't put up with, and don't deviate from that. You can't be one thing today and a different thing tomorrow. You have to be consistent. And when we bought the Jazz, they were losing money. They had never made money to that point. But Larry ran it like a business rather than the country club. And that enabled him to make money the first year. And I think that showed the dedication that we had to keeping it here, was that we were willing to do the things it took to stabilize it and to put a good product on the court. And then we decided that it had to reflect who and what we stood for. So we created benchmarks for players, what we wanted in our team and what we didn't want in our team. And that's hard to do because you can't be judge and jury for everybody. But you can say, this is who we are. This is what we stand for. We want what we're involved in to reflect that.
Well, and I think your values and your culture are aspirational for folks. And I think it's easier to get them to grasp onto that when it's viewed as being aspirational. And I think a lot of people want to work for a company where they say, you know what, this company's values aspire me to be the best version of myself that I can be.
Oh, thank you. We agree with that philosophy.
If you're just joining us today, our guest is Gail Miller, owner of the Larry H. Miller Group of Companies. You know, we're talking about culture and values and how you share that with your organization. Early on, there were a handful of dealerships. It very rapidly grew. Under your son Greg's leadership, the business basically doubled.
Right.
As I mentioned in the open, there's now over 10,000 employees in the entire group of Larry H. Miller companies. How do you, from a cultural standpoint, how do you keep those values, how do you keep that core consistent when it's so diverse and so big?
Well, as you mentioned, we do business clear across the U.S., and we realized early on after Larry passed away that people who are not in front of you all the time are quickly forgotten. We used to joke that at some point with our players, they would say, who? Even the stars. So we knew that as we grew, many of our employees would never know Larry or never know his drive or what he stood for. So we understood how important it was to keep the values we were built on alive. So my youngest son, who was a year and a half when we moved here, had unfortunately not had the closeness with Larry that the other kids had, even though that was not, you know, he was always working. So as he came into the business, he was kind of put in different slots. Larry'd say, you need to go here and work, and you need to go get that experience. But eventually he said, you know, Mom, we need to do something that will keep Larry alive, that will keep the values that we stand for alive. So he started a company within the company called Miller Inspiration, and it is based on the values that we were built on. And it's a company that we use to teach and train our employees throughout the company. And his program is called Who We Are. And so that's a program that we onboard people with. We use it as we're going through our training materials just to keep those values alive. And we have four values. We have integrity, stewardship, service, and hard work. So those are the four values. And then, of course, we have mission and vision and supporting statements to those values.
You know, and as you shared those, you know, Larry was more of the public figure, so I didn't know Larry, but I've seen him in the public light. And as you were saying those, they were all very consistent with who I viewed Larry as a consumer, as somebody, you know, just in the general public, which is really neat, and I think that's important. What about from a family standpoint, you know, helping your children understand from a family standpoint and how we work in business, what were some things that Larry did to help your family to pass that on to the next generation?
Well, I think the thing that helped the most is there weren't two Larrys. He was the same everywhere. He was a teacher. He was a person who expected results. He wanted the kids to toe the line. He wanted them to represent what we stood for, and they knew that. Even though he was not home a lot, he had an influence because they knew what he expected from them. And I used to get, you know, you talked about partnerships. I used to get really angry at him for not being there when I needed him, when the kids needed to have his influence in their life. And it wasn't until after he passed away that I realized he had more of an influence than I thought he did, that he had set standards and he had made them understand that that was expected of them. And in that way, he supported everything I did. So as far as the family culture, the hard thing for us was as we became public, which didn't happen until we bought the Jazz, I mean a public image, we were just normal people. We just lived in the community. Our kids played with the neighbors. We didn't have any other, you know, we didn't have any notoriety. But once you get into that public eye, everybody wants to know about you, and they want to give you their 2 cents worth. And the kids were at vulnerable ages when that happened. Our youngest was 10 years old. Greg would have been 22. But the ones that were home had a hard time putting that in perspective. Oh, your dad owns the Utah Jazz. You must be rich. And we weren't rich. And so the image that people had of them was really hard on them. And they, that was the challenge.
And you know, the irony, and I would think what makes it even more challenging is when your friends are thinking, oh, you own the Utah Jazz. You must be rich. In fact, just the opposite was true. It was never your goal to own the Utah Jazz. You were doing it as a gift to the community. And that very gift created challenges for your family. And unfortunately, as you know, that's kind of how life works.
Yes.
You know, you said Larry was one person, you know, same person you saw at work was the same person you would see at home. I think that takes a really supportive spouse because many times the traits that make you successful in business can make it challenging for you to be the type of parent that you want to be.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Did Larry struggle at all with that?
He struggled being a parent. I think the hard part for him was he knew his role at work. He knew how important he was as a leader. But in the home, because he hadn't been there as much as I had and hadn't had the interaction with the kids, he didn't understand how important he was. He thought I could do it all. And he thought that the kids would be just fine. Thank goodness he was there in absentia because he had the influence that he had. And then as the kids got older, they went to work for him, so they had that relationship. But it was really hard to create that bond between the kids and him when he wasn't there.
You know, a lot of people that listen to this show are business people. And many of them are running family businesses. What advice would you have for the family? And it seems like it's not as in vogue today as it was maybe 20 years ago to bring up your kids into the business, but there's still a lot of people that want to do that. Do you have any advice that you would share to them as family people, things that they might be able to do with their families to make it as positive of an experience as possible?
That's a lofty question.
Sorry.
I think the thing that I did was I would encourage my kids to not criticize their dad, that he was doing what he could to help keep us healthy and have what we needed, and that if they didn't like the kind of dad he was, be sure they were the kind of dad they wanted to have. And they've all turned out to be really good dads, partly because Larry eventually was looked at as a good dad and partly because they created what they didn't have for their families. And that's the closeness, the interaction, the family bonds.
You know, as a parent myself, I have 2 daughters, but that is one of my highest aspirations and hopefully will be one of the biggest compliments is how my kids end up being family members. And so I'm glad to hear that. That's touching. You're now kind of the public figure for the Miller companies. Having the business in the family, both for your kids and your grandkids and future generations, I understand is really important. I know that there was a change in the ownership management of the business where now there's a board of directors involved. Was that in the vein of how do we set up a structure where this can these companies can be a benefit to our family almost in perpetuity? Was that one of the major motivations?
Absolutely. We have, let me go back. I've just been to Harvard Business School and took a class in Families in Business, took my kids back.
Good for you.
Because I wanted to see what businesses are doing when they're at my place where I need to look at the future and keep things alive. And what they did was verified to me that what I'm doing is the right thing. But when we started in business, Larry and I were 100% partners. If he died, everything was owned by me. If I died, everything was owned by him because it was JTRS, Joint Rights of Survivorship. Before he passed away, we changed the structure of that and divided it for purposes of estate planning so that I owned half and he owned half. His half was all prepared for long-term succession, but it was only the estate part, the money part. And after he was gone, I realized that in order for that part to be compatible with the human part, we had to do something for succession, transition, governance that would create the vehicle for the money to last for as long as Larry wanted it to. So that's my focus right now, and that's the purpose for creating an outside board, because we're no longer an entrepreneurial business. We are a traditional business, and we need to be run like a traditional business, and we need an outside board to give us the experience that we don't have and the advice that we don't have in order to perpetuate what we've created, which is a really great company. And it would be a shame for it to get lost. But the other side of that, at Harvard Business School, we learned that 70% of businesses are family-owned businesses.
It's an enormously important part of our economy.
But only 5% of them make it to the second generation. And only 3% make it to the third generation. And I have third generation already working in the company. So it was like a bucket of cold water to me in realizing that I have to do something that creates a vehicle for this to go into the future and be successful, because already we have an outside CEO, a non-family CEO. I don't have anybody ready to step into where Greg was because they're not old enough and they haven't had the experience. So I have to have somebody, I have to have that vehicle while we're training new family members to be able to do that.
It sounds like a very well thought out plan. I love the fact that you shared, not only did you go to Harvard Business School, but you took some family members with you. I think that's really important. And, you know, as we get older, it's harder to take the time to go to things like this at the Harvard Business School and learn what some of the best practices are. You shared some stats about family businesses that are really scary.
They are.
And that's an overall number. The number gets worse the more complex your business is, the more difficult it is to pass from generation.
Right.
And your businesses are very complex, very people intensive.
Well, they're multifaceted, that's for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that's exactly the right approach. You know, you go to learn the best practices, you take your family members with you. I know Larry used to have, was it monthly meetings with family members? Weekly meeting. Tell us about that. What was he working to impart? And it was also the grandkids. Was it the grandkids that were monthly?
No, just the second generation, our kids. Okay. But his health had not been good for a long time, and he realized that his life may be cut short. He wasn't planning on it, but he knew. He was always a person that was able to look into the future and see what might happen. So one day he called everybody together around the kitchen table and he handed us notebooks and he says, "You're going to want to take notes because I'm going to teach you what you need to know to run this business, this company." And we did that for a year and a half before he passed away. And we had some good lessons. There were times when he would spend 3 or 4 hours just talking about how he had done things and why he had done things and how to do things, and And then there were exercises like he'd give us an imaginary amount of money and say, I want you to go invest this in the stock market and we'll watch it for 6 months and see how you do. And then after we did that, he gave us real money and said, now see what you can do. So it was a real good learning experience. And then we continued that after he passed away. And then once a month, we would bring in the third generation to kind of get them oriented to that kind of a process. And we continue that today.
Yeah, and I suspect you're very grateful that Larry took the time. It takes time to do that. But it's
and you
important.
Have to recognize the importance of it, because things don't happen by accident. You have to be very deliberate in how you do things and why you do things, and you have to be a teacher. You have to be able to impart to others things they need to know in certain situations.
If you're just joining us today, our guest is Gail Miller, owner of the Larry H. Miller Group of Companies. You know, we were talking just before we started the interview about, you know, you're in a position now where you're the head of the organization. That wasn't always the case. Early on, you weren't thinking you were going to be a business leader. That was really never on the radar screen of things you aspired to do back a long time ago.
Right.
You now are a business leader, and you transitioned from the outside to the inside. What were some of your biggest surprises when you got more involved in the business?
That's a very interesting question. Let me go back first to the fact that Larry was a teacher, and right from the very beginning in 1979, he would come home and download to me everything he'd done and everything he was doing. So in the sense of being partners, we really were partners because I knew about the business. Of course, I didn't have the firsthand knowledge like he did, but he shared everything with me. And part of it was that that's how he'd make decisions. He'd go over things and talk about them and bring me in and let me be a sounding board and give him advice. And so I learned the business from the very beginning. I didn't actually work in it, but I was a vicarious worker through him. So when he died, I understood instinctively that this can't be lost. And even at the press conference where we talked about his death, I said, we will continue the legacy that we've started. Now, I didn't know exactly how that would happen. I knew Greg was already the CEO, but I also knew that Larry said, you need to stay involved because they're going to need a bridge from me to them, and you have a lot of institutional knowledge. So as I did that, I started going to all the meetings that Greg had because Greg was not downloading to me like Larry did, and I didn't know what was going on. And I thought, okay, I'm the owner of this company. I need to know what they're doing and how they're doing it. And so the more meetings I went to, the more exciting I found out business was. And it kind of got under, you know.
I'm glad to hear that because it was a huge responsibility for you. And I'm glad to hear that you really are enjoying it.
Well, it is fun. And I have to learn some boundaries. I can't go in and say, you need to do this way. I have to give the people we have the right to do their jobs without interference. But I still have to know that they're following our philosophy and are taking care of our money and all the things that you would normally want to be aware of as an owner of a company. And then in addition to that, I've gotten involved in civic things in a way that I never had before. I had just started to be on different boards when Larry was trying to wind down. But it kind of accelerated after his death. And I made the statement, anybody that wants me to do anything, I'm going to do it, because I wasn't going to sit at home and pine. So I made myself available, and I took on challenges of things that I had never done before. And I find it very exciting. And I find that because of the background through Larry and watching him do things, that I have the courage to step up and kind of take that role. And I think it's important if you're going to stay in the public eye and you're going to continue the things that you've started as a legacy, you have to be out front. You have to be there doing it.
And, you know, Larry's pace was exhausting.
It was.
and you're doing, you know, overseeing all these companies as well as the civic involvement. Do you feel your pace is exhausting?
I do. Yesterday my whole day was one meeting right after another and no space between them. But they're not, not all days are like that, but there are enough of them that I go home at night and I think, I just want to get in bed. I just want to go to sleep.
I bet.
But they're still fun. And I do a lot of exciting things. Larry used to say, I do more things in a day than most people do in a lifetime.
I suspect there's a lot of truth to that. Maybe not a lifetime, but a year. And yeah, just incredible hearing his story and hearing your story, how much you guys did. You know, I read a story in the Deseret News, and the reporter, and I'm paraphrasing her, described Larry's personality as intense, driven, but with an artist, and this is where I'm paraphrasing, an artist outlook, something. What was meant by the artist component of that?
This is what I think he meant, because I know how Larry felt about artists. Larry felt that artists were very vulnerable people because they were tenderhearted, they were compassionate, and they were not strong in the decision-making. They needed somebody to take care of them. And I think in a way Larry was like an artist because he liked to create. The funnest thing he ever did was create businesses. He wasn't as excited about running them as he was making them happen. And he really did have a tender heart. And he was, to me, that's where I came in, was to take care of that part of him and keep it going.
Keep that part alive when the rest of the chaos was happening. If you're just joining us today, our guest is Gail Miller, owner of the Larry H. Miller Group of Companies. You know, I asked you what your biggest surprise was when you got involved in the business and took over the leadership role. I just want to set the context. That happened in 2009.
Right.
Your son Greg was running the automotive business. That was probably one of the toughest couple-year periods in our nation's automotive history.
That was
a really rough time to start. You know, ideally, you want to have a couple easy years under your belt while you learn things. How did you guys deal with that?
Well, the way we dealt with that was we prepared for it. Larry always preached, we don't know when it's coming, but there's going to be a downturn, and you guys need to be ready, not just to the family, but to all of his businesses. You need to know what he said. None of you have ever been through a downturn. And you need to be aware that it's coming, and when it comes, it'll hit so fast, if you're not prepared, you won't be able to react. So that was his philosophy. And so when it did come, we had to make some cuts. We had to make some hard decisions, but we also knew that we were in a good place and that we could survive it if we were sensible about it.
I mean, that was particularly the auto industry, right? Mm-hmm. People just stopped buying cars, and it's when we had the exchange, the cash for clunkers. So it impacted not only the new car sales, but the used car sales was happening.
Well, and I don't know that people realize how much money gets invested in the car inventory that you have. That's where all your money goes, because you have to buy those cars. And then when you sell them, you get your money back. So what you don't want to do is keep extra cars on the lot. So Greg was very sensible about that, and he said, instead of having a 60-day inventory, we need to cut it back to 30-day inventory, free up some of that money so we can use it to run the business. And he did I can't give Greg enough credit. He just did a very remarkable job of getting us through that.
That was an incredibly challenging time to take over leadership of a business and I think it speaks really highly to the work that, as you said, Larry said, you got to prepare for these days. You also have to prepare your family for those days.
Yes.
And you guys had worked as a team, so you felt prepared. I'm sure nobody really felt fully prepared for what we saw. But wow, what a foundation there. And it could have had a much different outcome. So I'm glad to see you guys navigate
it. It did for a lot of people. There were a lot of people that didn't make it through that in the car business, which was sad because you hate to see anybody lose what they've worked a lifetime for.
Absolutely. You know, many listeners might not know that you're a relative newlywed again.
Oh, yes.
A couple years ago, you got married, June 2012. You married Kim Wilson, who's an attorney at Snow Christensen in Madno. Thank you. How did you and Kim meet?
We don't know. We lived in the same neighborhood, and we were together in that neighborhood for 15 years before our spouses died. Larry died in 2009. His wife died in 2010, ironically, of diabetes and MS. And I had been the Relief Society president for 4 years, and during that time, his kids burned his house down twice. So
I saw that. I was going to ask. You got to tell. How does that happen twice? Obviously, it got rebuilt once, but
yeah, it got rebuilt twice. But one of them was his son came home, put grease on to fry scones, went away and left it on the stove. They rebuilt it. And then 4 years later, his daughter was doing laundry in the basement, put clothes on a smooth cooktop, and just turned the burner a little bit by accident, and it caused the clothes
to catch
on
fire. I've never heard of somebody's house burning down twice.
Ironically, his daughter's house caught on fire in Philadelphia this year, so it's a little scary.
Yeah, there's a family tradition going on there, right, that you want to stop as soon as possible.
So we had interaction with each other through those events, and I helped take care of his wife and his family during those trying times. So we don't actually know when we met, but after his wife died, he had taken care of her for, I don't know, 20 years. She was an invalid. And so for social events, he would take his daughters out. He started the Mormon Historic Sites Foundation, and he had some events that he wanted to go to, or an event. He said, I don't want to take my daughter, so I'm going to get a date. So we had common friends in that, because I sponsor the Joseph Smith Papers, and those are both church organizations, and his is not church, but it's church-related. So he thought, well, she'll be a good partner. She'll know the people. I'll invite her. And that was our first date. From there, we just kept going. And I had not planned to get married again. I didn't feel like it was something I wanted to do. And it took him a while to talk me into it.
Well, I'm sure Kim is very excited that you decided to say yes. Speaking of which, you told a fun story when I heard you speak at the Grand America about getting a proper proposal from Larry. And I know you and Kim had fun with that. Tell the story first about how Larry proposed, and then the fun that you and Kim had on that.
Well, Larry and I started dating in ninth grade, so we had a six-year history of dating. And in the sixth year, I was working at the telephone company, and I had enough seniority to get a vacation in the spring. And I figured 6 years is long enough to date. We ought to get married. So I went to Larry and said, I have a week in March. That would be a really good time to get married. So I think if you want to go that far, if you want to take that step, let's plan it. And if you don't, you need to move on, because I'm not going to spend any more time in this relationship.
So I gave him 6 years is a long time.
I gave him an ultimatum. Now, we learned a lot in those 6 years. We grew up together, but it was time, because you could spend your life dating, and I couldn't see him moving toward popping that question, so I had to nudge him a little bit. But he was willing, so we got married. So since I proposed to Larry, I thought, if Kim wants to get married, he's going to have to give me the proposal I never had. So it ended up that I was looking at an apartment in the Promontory building downtown, thinking I would move there and get out of my big house. And he got the man who was showing the apartments to let him in one day, and he orchestrated a rose petal floor and a table set with dinner and candlelight. And we had gone down just to look at it one more time, and Chris Caroon to leave us alone. We went up to the apartment I was looking at, and the table was set, and I knew right away what he was doing.
Sure.
So that's how he proposed to me, and we ended up buying that unit. So we now live in the unit that he proposed to me in.
Well, it worked, so good for Kim. That was a good strategy. Excellent.
It was a good sport.
And I know you and Kim like to travel, and it was something that was hard for Larry to do just because he was so busy with everything. What do you think in traveling internationally? What are some takeaways that you've gotten from that, just your outlook on life from your world travels?
Well, I traveled a lot, even though Larry didn't, because during our advertising, he would win trips from KSL or KUTV, the radio stations, the the dealerships would, the manufacturers would have trips. So I would take the kids and travel with me. We had some really great trips. Would have been fun with Larry, but he wasn't doing that, so we did made the best of that. Kim was not able to travel much because his wife was so ill for so long. So once we got married, we decided that we would do some of the traveling that he had never done. So we'd been married 9 days. We went on a 3-week trip with Greg, who did an Expedition 7 trip. So that means he took 2 Land Cruisers and drove those 2 Land Cruisers on all 7 continents.
Wow.
The trip we went on was the European leg of that. So we were gone for 3 weeks. We went through Norway, Finland, Sweden, Latvia, Lithuania, Czech Republic, Prague, and then went over to Italy and spent a week. So after, and a lot of that was camping. So that was kind of our initiation into traveling and seeing if we were compatible to do such. Then after that, we've done China and Africa and
good for you
New
for
Zealand.
Camping. As I get older, it gets harder and harder to enjoy the full 24 hours of a camping trip.
Yeah, but we had a good time, and we have done some really fun traveling.
Yeah. Speaking of which, it takes a lot of energy. I mean, Kim married into the Miller family. You guys are a fast-paced family. You do a lot.
We do. He said, after we'd been dating for a little while, he said, I realize now that the Millers live a whole year in 1 month.
Get done more in a day than most people do in their lifetime.
Right.
That's great. You mentioned earlier some of the civic organizations that you're involved in, and I wanted to give you a couple minutes to kind of share with us some of the organizations that you're passionate about.
Well, right now I'm serving on the Mayor's Commission on Homeless, and our charge was to determine whether the homeless sites should stay where they are or be reconfigured, or if they should move from that site and be scattered. We've spent a year in interviews and discovering all of the elements that go into making a decision like that. It's been a real eye-opener. We've talked a lot with providers in the Rio Grande area. What I've discovered is every one of them is an angel. They do such tremendous work in taking care of the homeless. But we have a huge problem of homelessness, and we need to get a solution to it so that not only can we prevent homelessness from happening, but we can help those who are in homelessness get on their feet and get back into a community and be productive, healthy citizens.
It is a huge problem. You know, this radio station studio is on the campus of the main Salt Lake City Library, and there's a lot of homelessness around here, and it breaks my heart, and I think it breaks a lot of people's heart. What can people do to help?
Well, I think they can realize that they are our brothers and sisters, and that they do not choose, most of them do not choose to be homeless. It's an event in their lives that has caused it. It's a turn of the economy. And for one reason or another, they're in a situation where they need help, but don't give them money. That encourages them to stay homelessness. And in reality, it's my understanding that panhandlers generally are not homeless people. They're people who've learned how to make a living by panhandling, and it gives the homelessness a bad rap. And I think the other thing is if people will understand that you can't paint this problem with a broad brush, because there are subpopulations of homelessness. There are women and children. They need a different kind of solution. There are single men who want to work. They need a solution. There are single women who've been abused. They need a solution. There are youth, and they need a different solution. So we need to learn to look at each one in their own environment and find something that will take care of that problem. And once we do that, then it will expose those who prey on the homeless, who cause the bad image of drugs and crime, because there are some homeless that are involved in that, but I think for the most part they're people who come in and take advantage of a bad situation and use the homeless as a cover for selling drugs. And so if people will just realize that there is work being done to help this problem. It's not going to be taken care of overnight. And if they want to donate, that the city, the county, the state.
Is there an easy way for them to do that? Is there an organization that you can share that people could support?
I don't have that information in front of me, but I know there are places that they can donate.
It's a big problem. You know, I was driving. I had a meeting last week in Salt Lake City, and it just started to snow. And up till now, we've had pretty warm weather.
Yes.
And it was a morning meeting, and I was driving down the street, and I saw, you know, where somebody had spent the night over by Pioneer Park. And we were joking about camping, and at 51 years old, it's getting harder for me to camp. So difficult. It's such a big problem. We had a guest on the show over the summer, maybe 6 months ago now, Bryson Garbett,
yes.
Who I think might be serving on the same committee with you.
And, right. Well, and he's on the county's committee.
He's on the county. And he actually spent 2 days.
Three days,
two nights in the life of a homeless person. And he was staying at a shelter. And he shared that story. And it's a huge problem. And I'm glad to hear that. You know, your family is a family that gets things done. This is a really important cause, so thank you for being involved
in
that.
We're working very hard to find a way to get this problem taken care of. And I met with Jackie Biskupski yesterday, and I'm grateful that she has the same outlook that we do, and we're very aligned in what needs to be done, as was Mayor Becker. So I think the players are in place to be able to get something significant.
I'm glad to hear that. Gail, thanks for spending the time with us this morning. Before we let you go, I just wanted to ask, you know, what are you hoping for in the future for you and your family?
Well, first, unity. I think that's important. You have to have family unity. And the bigger we get, the harder that is, because people go all different directions. But I think with the new programs I'm putting in place for transition and succession and education, that will be accomplished. And then, of course, I want continued success. I want to be able to do the things that we do that make a difference.
Well, it sounds like you guys are doing that in with great success, which I'm glad to hear. Thank you so much for spending your time with us this morning.
Thank you. It's been a privilege.
Our guest this morning has been Gail Miller, owner of the Larry H. Miller Group of Companies. Today's show was recorded at the KCPW Studios on Library Square and produced by Ross Chambliss. Thank you, Ross. You can hear my entire interview with Gail on our website, kcpw.org. You can tweet me, @SavvyWells or @KCPW, bottom line. I'm Doug Wells. Join us next week on The Bottom Line.